Anyway, get an old friend of Blue Ridge Speakers Group. Welcome, Arnold.
All right.
Hi, everybody. My name's Arno, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Arno.
Hear me okay? Glad to be here. Glad to be sober. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1991. My home group is the Midtown Group. We meet in Rockville, Maryland right now. And I have a sponsor. His name is Johnny, and he lives in Long Beach. And I was fortunate enough to be at in California a few weeks ago at a retreat that he was doing, actually not a retreat, a big book study. And it was wonderful to be out there. It'd been a while since I'd seen him. And I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I can't drink safely. I cannot drink safely. I am glad to be here. You know, I was really happy to, you know, be asked by Billy, and you know, thank you for that. It's been a while since I've been here. You know, it's interesting, you know, driving down here, flooded with memories. You know, we've done so many AA events together, driving down with my sponsor. My sponsor did a workshop, I don't know, probably 15 years ago. It was a few years before he died. And so anyways, I was having some really nice memories on the way down of shared sober experiences, positive experiences that were replacing the old stuff that didn't work and was not a lot of fun. And, you know, I just had a, you know, an anniversary of my wedding, 21st anniversary, and last month. And there'd be a lot to celebrate, except we're divorced now 10 years. So, and she's remarried, you know, but so it's like that. But, you know, we, you know, share two kids and we get along great. You know, in fact, I just saw them both yesterday at my son's football game. So we have a common interest in our children, and her new husband has been a part of their lives. They like him. He's been very kind to them, and I'm very grateful for that. Feel lucky for that. You know, I think the last time I spoke here was right when we got separated. So it was pretty dark. In fact, I think it took me about 50 minutes to get sober in my story. So I promise you, I will get sober before 7:50 tonight, you know? So I have 30 years experience, and I don't wanna spend a whole lot of time on the problem. But you know, having that identification is important. I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Like I said, I got that way by drinking alcohol. I didn't just think about it, I did it, you know? My circumstances, you know, so I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like now. I was born in Oklahoma, two parents. My father, you know, had a job. He had pretty much two jobs his whole career after college. I've had about 20, you know, and my mom was a nurse. I was the firstborn. My younger brother, who's about 20 months younger than me, was born maybe a year after that. My mom went into a depression. And this is before they knew about postpartum depression. And she got institutionalized, got put on all kinds of meds. And my dad was the worker, the cooker, the laundry, the home cleaner, you know? So things were a little weird at my house. Now, I only bring that up. I don't blame any of this on why I'm an alcoholic. It's just, these are just facts, just what my life was like. But I do remember going, you know, my dad would send us back to try to cheer up my mom, you know, and which is, you know, pretty much an impossible task to try to cheer somebody up who's in a depressive state, you know, and I never liked that. My avoidance of my family and that situation started at an early age. I grew to hate my father at an early age. From 6 years old, I had a plan: go to college, get the hell out, you know, get the hell out of this place. I did, you know, since coming in here, I found out that I could have just run away, you know, but I was, I guess, kind of a wimp, you know, and just never did it, you know, when I was in that situation. But I grew up hating my father, and he was a bit of a rageaholic and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, again, I don't blame him for why I'm an alcoholic. It was just the situation, you know. In fact, today, I know that as a human being and a member of society, he was doing much better at that age than I was, you know. So, but I'll get to that in my story. So anyways, that's where we were born. And, you know, I was allergic to peanut butter and egg whites. So we had Benadryl around the house. So I used to go and take a few cupfuls of this Benadryl as a 4 or 5 year old, and made me feel good for about 5 seconds before I took a nap, you know. Anyways, my dad got a job that moved us to California. We spent some time before the move down at my uncle's farm in Texas. We spent a week as a family, and then my parents left me with my uncle and my probably 5 or 6, maybe 9 cousins. I don't know. It was a lot on the farm while they went back home to pack up our house in Oklahoma. And during this time, the kids were in charge of babies. I was the youngest. I was 6 years old. And one day they figured it would be fun to give me a beer. So I had my first drink. It was a Budweiser, and it was wonderful. I don't know if I had it all, but I do. It felt really good. And I think it tasted good. The whole thing was good. You know, boy cousins, girl cousins. And then the boy cousin said, you know, let's play a joke on the girls. And he had a 38 revolver, and he put a blank in there and put a white t-shirt on me and got ketchup or some tomato sauce. And anyways, shot the gun off and I'm lying on the floor. The girl cousins come in, they're horrified, crying. I wake up, go, surprise. And they were not amused, you know? And, but that was my first night drinking, you know, a little bit of drama, or first day, you know, that was a day drink. Might have even been morning. But anyways, I was 6 years old. I loved it, but I didn't go chasing it. You know, I didn't wake up the next day under a bridge, or, you know, I've never woken up under a bridge. So that's the way it was. My parents came to pick me up for the drive to California a few days later. And I remember looking in our station wagon. I had a dog. It was a border collie mix, or a collie mix, collie German Shepherd. His name was Buzzy. And Buzzy was not in the station wagon. And I got really upset. And I looked, and they were looking at me. Like, I think they were wondering, like, will he notice that the dog's not with us? Because they didn't say anything. I said, where's Buzzy? And they both looked shocked at each other. Oh, my God. You know, he realizes that the dog isn't here. And I said, Buzzy can't make the move because the yard in California is too small, you know. And I was pissed. I was not even consulted about this. And I tell you what, I didn't know that was a resentment. I was resentful at them. And how I did it was I did not talk to them for the next 2 or 3 days that we drove across half the US. That is how I deal with resentments. I don't talk. So I hate my father. Now I'm not talking to him. And I have no... I mean, I've put myself beyond help here by my parents, who are supposed to, you know, influence me and shape me. And I've already made all my own decisions about what I'm going to do, how I'm going to think, how I'm going to feel. And I had my first blackout at around 10 or 11 years old, throwing up through the nose, all that kind of stuff. Woke up the next day, the dry throw up in the nostrils is not fun. But it was a fun night because I became the group project of all my friends. They were walking me around the neighborhood, trying to figure out how to sober me up. They tried many things, put me in a shower. That didn't work. They gave me a gallon of milk, which is why I threw up, and that didn't work. And my younger brother ended up taking care of me that night. And it was fun because, you know, when I showed up to school that following Monday, I was the talk of the town. You were so crazy last Saturday. Oh, wow, that was awesome. That was great. You know, so much fun. And it was a lot of fun for a little while. I did good in school. I thought school was my way out, my passport, and got really good grades. And as long as I did that, my parents weren't on my back about anything. For the most part, I was a good kid. I was going to say I'm not a thief. Well, I am, you know, but petty, you know, just shoplifter. I'd like to say I was an honest person. I wasn't. The dishonesty started at a very young age too, stealing things, lying about them. You know, I got caught red-handed once by my father and, you know, got embarrassed. He made me, you know, we went back to the store, made me pay for it. I think it was his money though, but I paid for it, you know, and I was embarrassed to go up there and admit what I had done. And I learned a very valuable lesson that day. If you're going to steal something at the store when you're there with your father, don't eat it until you're home alone in your room, you know? And that's what I did, you know? So I'm not an honest person, you know? I'm selfish, I'm resentful, I'm hateful. This is bad news, you know. This is not, you know. This is ripe for alcoholism. And then the other thing that I got that you know doesn't happen to everybody is I have this reaction to alcohol that once I start drinking, the phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I cannot say no once I have that first drink. And that, looking back on my drinking history, not every single time when I drank was I out of control, but there were many times that, you know, I'm just going to have one or two. And then the next thing I know, you know, it's the next day. I wake up drunk still from the night before. That phenomenon of craving that kicked in. And I also had the obsession. The obsession was there from the beginning. Once I had that first drunk, I couldn't wait until the next one. My friends, we were very lucky. You know, I feel bad for a lot of the people who come in young who say, you know, they didn't drink much because it wasn't really accessible to them. So they just did other things. We always found a way to get it. You know, we would pay, you know, the street bum down at the store to go buy us some beer, you know, and buy him a six pack or whatever. You know, I mean, you know, there was always a way to get it. Our older siblings would get us, you know, friends, older siblings would get it for us. So we always had access. And anytime there was a Friday or a Saturday night from the time I was very young, it was more fun and it was way more of an adventure when there was drinking involved. And if there wasn't drinking involved, I really wasn't interested, you know, from the early age. You know, I ended up doing well in high school. I applied to two colleges and got into one, so that's pretty good odds, right? And waited to the last minute. I'm a last minute person. Just, you know, everything's always in an emergency. It's like a rush with me and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I get angry at my parents, you know, because I need help, but I don't know how to ask. And you know, this entitlement, just bad attitude, ungrateful. Son that I was. And I got into a school in San Diego, which was, you know, 3 hours away from where I grew up, far enough away from my parents where, you know, I didn't have to worry about them, but then close enough, you know, if I needed to go back, I could. And, you know, the very and that's really where my drinking took off. There was no authority. I almost failed out in the first 2 years, academic probation, on campus living probation for drunken incidents, visits to the hospital, many times puking, blacking out. I would get violent when I drank. My thing was to try to start to get you angry enough to want to fight me and then talk you out of it. I don't know why I did that, but that's what I did. And it usually worked. And I always picked, the guy that was taller, bigger, all that kind of stuff. So I had a real chip on my shoulder. Did not know how to be a friend. Didn't know how to be a boyfriend. Obviously, didn't know how to be a son. Was failing as a student. And, my sophomore year, my father had a massive heart attack. And he's 49 years old. And so this is very traumatizing. Remember going home, seeing him in the ICU, and he looked like a different person. And I was scared. My mom was scared. I'm the oldest. I'm starting to think weird stuff, like I'm going to have to drop out of school, get a job, take care of my younger brothers, all kinds of stuff like that. And it shook me up. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to deal with this. And so I think I cried when I saw him. And when I cried, it really upset my father. And he told my mom, don't let the boys come see me anymore. It upset him too much. And I took that to a whole new level, because my dad ended up having a quadruple bypass. He was in the hospital for like a month. And besides that first visit, I don't think I ever saw him in the hospital. The next time I saw him was when school was over. And I had just pretty much put my college career in jeopardy because I didn't end the year with enough credits. I was going to have to do summer school. I was sick. But I tell you, that heart attack really kind of woke me up because up to this point, I'd become at least a 5-night-a-week drinker. I was a daily, outside issue smoker, and I did other things too. And it woke this heart attack woke me up, and I said, I can't do this other stuff anymore. And so I just kept on drinking. And it seemed like, here I am about to fail out of school and all this stuff is happening. And I was able to rally a little bit. And the next year in school, I started doing well and all this kind of stuff. But I was a total disappointment. I was a horrible son to my father. All he wanted me to do during the summer, it was our arrangements. I paid for half of my school. He paid for half. So I worked during the summer. And that was, my money to spend during the school year. And then, he paid for the tuition and then I paid for everything else. And he's convalescing. He's still on disability from his heart attack from, the surgery. And I am pretending to go look for a job. And I just go around the block to my buddy's house and we drink and we watch MTV. And, my dad gave me 10 bucks for gas and the 10 bucks went for beers. And that was repeated, weeks while I was home during the summer. I had no regard for him, his wishes, didn't give a rat's ass about anybody but myself. I did end up getting a job and ended up going back to school and didn't fail out, but it took me 6 years to graduate and just six and for a 4-year degree, that's not too bad. I know I have a lot of friends that took like 20 years. So it's, don't judge me, judge them. And at this time too, though, my life was in a decline and I didn't know how much of a decline it was. It seemed like if I really look back, I peaked at around 17 or 18 in my life. And it was around 7 or 8 years of just a decline and, you know, distancing from my family, losing friends, drinking them away. I was too much of a liability. They didn't want to go out with the guy who might get in a fight and, you know, cause stuff. So nobody wanted to hang with me, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, my last drink was in Las Vegas. I spent 3 pretty strange days there, a three-day drunk with people who were like me, who drank like I drank, where it didn't matter what you did. There's no apologies ever necessary. I had something happen during this last drink or drunk during New Year's Eve, which, you know, I can't explain. But maybe it was a moment of clarity. Maybe it was a wake-up call. But during a fall-down, brown-out drunk, I am being asked to leave the establishment. It was a bar or a club I was in by the bouncer. And I remember seeing the guy I was there with, and we were chasing a couple women who were on the dance floor. And I was looking at him, and I looked at his face, and he's a good looking guy and all this kind of stuff. And I looked at him though, and I thought, like, damn, he's angry. You know, he looks bitter. He looks alone. And then it hit me. I'm looking at myself. That is me. I am describing me. And it's like something happened in my mind where a tape started playing. I see a coffin. I see a priest. I see my parents off in the distance, and I knew it was my funeral, you know, and, you know, a dusty old graveyard, you know, and I don't know about you, but these are buzzkill thoughts, you know, and so it felt like something on the inside of me just blew up. So hard to explain, but I had to get out of there. I didn't want to be seen like this. And so I got out of there. I ended up somehow making it back to the hotel I was staying at with the friends I was with, and woke up in the next day, basically dressed how I am right now, you know, jacket, tie, pants, shoes, except I was wearing socks because it was Vegas New Year's Eve and it was colder. And I woke up on top of the bed. My top button was buttoned. It was like timber. I'm out. And then I woke up the next day, probably some dried saliva. You know, I had to scrape off on the side of my mouth, and still drunk for sure from the night before and a few days before. But that feeling that my life just blew up was with me. And I grabbed all my stuff, got in my car, and I started the 350-mile drive home from Las Vegas to San Diego. And it was a rough ride. It was a really rough ride. I had to pull over to these truck stop bathrooms that had never seen a janitor, you know, in their lifetime. And I thought I was going to just heave my guts out. You know, I thought I was going to die. You know, my intestines were going to come out everywhere, you know, and it was horrible. Made it home somehow. You know, and up until this point, you know, my drinking became I was a daily drinker. I was having physical problems, blood in the toilet. You know, I was having these issues at night. You know, I don't know if it was allergies or, you know, I'd wake up coughing, you know, snot coming out of my nose. I didn't know what was going on with me. And I am not there was no Google then. And I'm not like going to call a doctor to figure out what's going on, you know, because my thought is always, it's not a big deal. This will pass, you know? And so I get home and after this on New Year's Day and, you know, I can't sit on my bed because the TV on the other side of the room is moving around. Things are moving that shouldn't be moving. And I intuitively knew that this is not right, you know, but something happened this day. I was so sick and I was so messed up from that experience that I didn't drink. I didn't want to drink. It was like I was almost struck sober. Woke up the next day, you know, it was a horrible night, horrible detoxing night. Woke up the next day, went to work, and people at work were asking me, they're looking at me funny. You okay, Arno? You don't look good, you know? And it was the first time in a while where I couldn't put off that image, you know, that, because, you know, I a lot of times didn't feel good on the inside, but could always put on a face, you know, I'm okay. Don't ask me how I'm doing, you know, stay away. And it seemed like that image was wiped away for a little while. You know, it was like a thin veneer that got ripped off when I had that experience. And I became a see-through person, and I didn't like it. I felt raw. And more than one person asked me if I was okay. And I said, yeah, I'm okay. I'm okay. You know, I told them what happened over the weekend. They said, oh man, you know, that's not good. You know, you could have died or whatever, you know? And I was like, oh, it's not a big deal. And, you know, a couple of days later, I'm walking into the office, and front desk receptionist person asked me, how are you doing, Arno? And, you know, and up to this point, you know, she was a little bit younger than me, really super nice. I didn't know much about her, but I knew a couple of things. One, she didn't drink, because she was never drinking at any of our company parties. Two, she had just gotten married. She got married into with to a Mormon, you know, and a bunch of us from work were at her wedding. And it was kind of a dry reception. So it was kind of a lame wedding, you know, except for us. We had booze out in the cars, you know, we would go out there to drink. She was a super nice person, but she asked me how you're doing, how am I doing? And I tell you, I wasn't doing good. I'm not doing good. And I told her, I said, not good, you know? And that was like, you know, did I really say that out loud? You know, because I'm not an honest person. You know, I don't tell people what's really going on. And she said, what are you doing for lunch? And I thought, wow, this could get weird. She's married, you know, and she's asking me out to lunch, you know? I mean, well, nothing. I'm not doing anything for lunch. You know, I thought I'd see where this went, you know, and we went to lunch, and she told me, she started talking to me. She wasn't asking me any questions. She started telling me how she used to drink, and she used to go down to Tijuana. You know, this is San Diego, so it's about an hour drive, not even that. And she said, in fact, she used to go with her friends on a Friday, come back on Sunday. And a lot of times she was missing her underwear. She told me that she ended up going to rehab, you know, detox and all this kind of stuff. And that she had gotten sober, and she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, at that point, she was sober 4 years. And she started telling me, she goes to meetings every day. She sponsors other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she has commitments and H&I and all this kind of, you know, things I don't even know what that is, you know, but that's, you know, felt like it was nice for her, you know, I was happy for her. Seemed like she needed it, you know, we finish lunch and get in the car, drive back to the office, and we're just chit-chatting. She says, so do you think you're an alcoholic? And I, you know, I'm not dumb. I know after she spent all this time talking to me about alcoholism, that the right answer for me to say is yes. So I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, do you want to come to a meeting with me? And that's where it's like, you know, the solution is right in front of me. And I said, no, not really. Thank you, though. I really appreciate your help. You know, she said, that's fine. She must have read the book. She said, you know, maybe you're not an alcoholic. I don't know. But if you are an alcoholic, and if you don't drink, your life is going to, you're going to get to the point where you're in so much pain that you will either drink again or you can ask for help. She patted me on the shoulder. walked into the, you know, said, good luck, you know, or, you know, whatever, you know, like, I wish you the best, you know, whatever you want to do. And I walked in the office and then left me alone, you know. And I walked by her desk every day for the next, you know, week and a half or so. And she didn't ask how I was doing. She just said hello. She was polite. She was courteous. She didn't ask how my not drinking going. You know, you don't look so good, Arno. She's like, I didn't know this. She's like one of the best AA closers I've ever seen, you know, because she kept quiet. You know, she asked the question, she kept quiet. And then a week and a half later, what she had said came true. I am, you know, I thought just stopping drinking is going to make me feel better. And it did a little bit, physically, a little bit. But then I'm left with the problem that I really have. And that is, I don't know how to live sober. And all this stuff is happening, life, and I can't deal with it. I am paranoid. I'm afraid. I'm anxious. I'm having panic attacks. I just don't know how to live life. And I'm about to lose my mind. And I asked her one day, I said, you still going to those meetings? She said, yes. And that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am forever grateful for her. Her name is Jana, and God, she and her husband. I mean, I tell you, looking back, you know, I'm this jackass 25-year-old, you know, who thinks he's something, but is really totally a nobody. And this woman, her husband, you know, under a year, are taking me in on every Friday night. I'd go to dinner with her and her husband. We'd have enchiladas or whatever, tacos, and, you know, different things. Then her and I would go to the meeting. Her husband was not an alcoholic. Then we'd come back to her place afterwards. She had a, you know, one or two bedroom apartment with him. Pick him up, get frozen yogurt, and then maybe get a movie or something like that. And that was my Friday night, you know, my first several Friday nights in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time, I'm telling you, it felt like my life is over. You know, this is lame. This is the worst, you know, this is like hell, you know, the worst hell that I could ever imagine. But looking back, it's actually the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. You know, the kindness of these people, you know, what they did, interrupting their marital life, interrupting their relationship, interrupting their time together to let a jackass like me stay with them. And there were several Friday nights. She would say, I don't know if she thought I was shaky or whatever. She would say, you know, it's 11 o'clock. There's a lot of drunks out on the road. Why don't you just sleep on the couch tonight, Arno? You know? And I thought about it. I go, God, I wanted to say, okay, but I don't want to hear marital bliss going on in the bedroom, you know, because it was a small apartment, you know? And luckily I didn't hear anything. So they're very quiet or nothing was happening, but, and I did that, and you know, it felt awkward, felt awful at the time, but man, what a gift. And, you know, it is, cause you know, up until this point, I'm still not sure I'm an alcoholic. I come to AA, there's some nice people here, but it doesn't seem like the place for me. I'm glad it's the place for you, but you don't understand me. My case is a little different. I'm a little too good for the bad people and not bad enough for the good people or something. I don't know. You know, I mean, I just don't feel like I fit in here. And so I wasn't convinced of a lot of things for a while. Only thing I was convinced of at this point, I could not go back to drinking. That was untenable for me. I could not do that. And but I didn't know how that would happen. And what ended up happening for me is that I got to the point, you know, and our book talks about, you know, getting to the point where I couldn't see going on drinking and I couldn't see going on staying sober. And that is a dark, dark spot. That's a point where, you know, that's the jumping off place. That's a place where, you know, you will feel loneliness that few do. And I arrived at that place you know, right up, you know, about 10 months sober, I'd done a move across the US, which wasn't recommended. But again, my case is different. So I rules don't apply to me. I don't take suggestions. I just tell you what I'm going to do, you know, and hope for the best. And ended up out here, God, just floundering. I knew what to do. And I did it for a week. And then I just couldn't do it. I didn't have the power to carry anything out. I wasn't connected to anybody or anything. And I ended up in a compulsion. I thought on a Sunday, I woke up and I felt the worst I'd felt my entire sobriety. I felt like I was going to end up drinking against my will, or my head was going to explode, or I was just going to like freak the heck out, you know? I didn't know what to do. I took out the meeting list. Scrambled, you know, rallied, you know, put myself together a little bit and clothes on, and went down to a noon meeting. I got there at like 12:30, left before the prayer, didn't feel better, got back to my apartment, maybe watched football, distracted myself for a little bit, didn't feel better, looked at the where and when again, rallied, found another meeting. I got there and, you know, I mean, this is like fall, it's like October. You know, it's getting dark earlier. I'm starting to see leaves on the ground. It's starting to get cold out. I don't have a winter coat or anything. You know, I just moved from California, and I'm freaking out. And I go in this meeting, and I think it might've been a 5 o'clock meeting. I get there at like 10 to six. I sit down. It was in a basement of a high-rise apartment building. There's a bunch of columns in the room, and the acoustics were bad, so they had microphones. You had the Sharono microphone. You know, the microphones go around the room. And I was in my head. I wasn't really paying attention to anything. And the microphone came to me, and I didn't know the rules. I didn't know I could pass it on. I didn't know I could just say pass, whatever. I took the microphone and said, "My name's Arno. I'm an alcoholic. I just moved here from California not too long ago, and I'm crazy. Thanks for letting me share." You know, and again, you know, accidentally got honest, you know, and probably tried to play it off like saying it jokingly, you know. You know, little, and I'm the last guy to share, right? I didn't know it, you know, so on that hope, you know, hopeful message I just put out there, everybody stood up and, you know, circled up and, you know, held hands. And again, I usually, up to this point, really, my MO is to leave the meeting before the prayer. And I couldn't do that. So I said the prayer. As soon as the prayer was over, grabbed my jacket, and I was on the way out the door, and somebody cut me off. And he said, "Hey, where are you going?" Said, "Well, meeting's over, you know, why?" You know, he's like, "Well, I'm going to another meeting. You know, you want to come with me?" And I'm feeling, you know, I still feel bad. And I'm feeling like, in my mind, I've just done two meetings, buddy. You know, I mean, you know, I showed up late to both. And, you know, anyways, I feel like I've just done two meetings. I've done my part. And I didn't say that. And, so I was feeling like, God, a third, do I even contemplate that? And I was supposed to go out with a couple people who drank. And I'm feeling how I'm feeling. And one thing I know in Alcoholics Anonymous is when the desire and the opportunity cross, I am a dead man. And the desire for some kind of relief was there. And I was about to step into the opportunity. And I said, "Well, I'm supposed to hang out with these people. Let me go call them and see what's going on." And I called both of them. Their answering machines picked up, and I started to freak out because I didn't want to go home alone, because, again, I'm still not feeling good. You know, so I, against all better judgment, I got in the car with this guy. You know, I didn't know what his intentions were. I was disobeying my mom's order since I was 5 years old, you know, never get in a car with a stranger and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just feeling like, oh God, this is, I hope this doesn't get weird. And, you know, and it didn't, you know, he talked about AA, he talked about, he's recently broke up with a girlfriend and, you know, never reached over, put his hand on my knee or anything like that. So it was a nice car ride. I get to the meeting that, you know, all this years later is my home group. You know, I had met probably 50 people that night, and I didn't know what was going on there, but it seemed like something was going on. You know, people were smiling, they were happy, they seemed like they were living life, they were living in a way different way than I was living, and that was attractive. And I started, you know, he gave me a meeting list, he circled the meetings he went to, and I started to show up to those meetings. And he was a good AA member, still is a good AA member, still sober. And I started to show up to those meetings. And shortly after that, I got a sponsor, my first sponsor, Mike, who started directing my life. And his very first question to me, what are you doing tonight? This is after the meeting. I just asked him to be my temporary sponsor. And we never upgraded that status, Mike, if you're listening, you know, and I always kept him, you know, on his toes. You know, I might find somebody better or whatever, but he asked me what I was doing. I said, you know, and this is the state I arrived to him at. I don't know. I'd run out of ideas. You know, I tried to arrange life to suit myself in sobriety up to that point. It didn't work. Picking and choosing what I was going to do, what I'm not going to do, didn't work. And I just started doing what he said. And he was the perfect guy for me because he did not care about how I felt. He did not care about hurting my feelings. He would tell me what he thought was the truth, no matter what. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, I got busy, you know, with him in Alcoholics Anonymous a few months later. I'm having breakfast with this guy, Frank, who is laying out the four column format for the inventory and telling me how to do this. He made me breakfast. It was really good. He loved to cook for people. He loved to do one-on-one work. And a few weeks later ended up, actually it wasn't a few weeks later. It was a few months later because it took me several months and about 3.5 hours to do a four step, several months to think about it, you know, and then 3.5 to actually write it. You know, I try to be as thorough as possible. I went all the way back as far as I can remember, you know, the incident in Oklahoma or in Texas when my dog wasn't there. Other things, you know, before and other things after, any place where I, you know, was angry. I didn't believe that I'm somebody who lets things go. I just sweep it under the rug, you know, so things I'm living with this anger that's just beneath the surface. And if you do anything to touch it, you know, if you get close to it, you know, watch out because I'm going to explode. And that's how I was. Ruined a lot of relationships with anger and rage and stuff like that. You know, I ended up doing up to this point too, you know, 18 months sober. I, again, still not convinced that AA is the right place for me. I am having a hard time going to sleep. It seems like I am physically tired at night, lie down and my head hits the pillow. And all of a sudden the brain wakes up and says, oh, hey, Arno, glad you're here. You know, let's talk about the day. You know, you were kind of an asshole earlier. You know, in fact, you know, you remember 5 years ago, you know, you were a jerk then too. And it would just, you know, just go and go and go. And from, you know, from the time I was 9 years old, I could not just lie down and go to sleep. I had to listen to music. I had to take cough medicine. I had to have a beer. I had to have a smoke. I had to have something to calm the brain down because the brain was always so active at night. And I'm also paranoid, you know, this is sober, 18 months, uncomfortable, you know, awkward socially. I was, armpit sweater and, you know, I'd get these jobs to, you know, greet at the door. And I felt like that was just pure humiliation, you know, for the newcomer, you know, they're watching me sweat, you know, feeling my sweaty palms and all that kind of stuff. And it felt like so cruel to me at the time. So I had a lot of lot of problems, you know, going, hanging out afterwards and, you know, where am I going to sit at the diner? You know, what if there's all the booths are taken? What am I going to do? You know, that kind of thought just plagued with that. And ended up doing my fist step, and it was in the basement of my sponsor's house. And at first he seemed very interested, you know, sitting upright, looking engaged, eager, you know, to learn more about me. You know, I'm feeling, oh wow, I got his full attention, you know. And then I don't know, part of the way through, he laid down, you know, and then closed his eyes. And you know, I just stopped reading every once in a while just to make sure he wasn't sleeping, you know. And he said, keep going, you know. And anyways, it was a couple hours, and you know, I thought, like, he's not even listening, you know. And but anyways, I said what I needed to say, let out some secrets, all this kind of stuff. And and what had made it easier is that up until that point, he had been sharing things about himself with me, embarrassing things. In fact, things that I made me think, like, I have the wrong sponsor, like he's really bad, you know. And I'm not that bad, but you know, he shared it, and he made it easier for me to share these things with him. And I found that that's an amazing thing, you know. We're taught when we grow up that it's, you know, we share our successes, you know, from podiums like this, and that makes people adore us, right? You know, people in the audience want to be the person and all this kind of stuff. But in AA, we share our weaknesses and our failings. And that is what draws us closer here. And that's an amazing thing. Never thought that that would be possible. And anyways, I did the fist step, and, you know, I was, you know, all sweaty and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know, we finished, and I think we probably went to a meeting that night. You know, I just continued to be busy in AA. And, you know, I called him the next day. He took my phone call. So obviously I didn't say anything too reprehensible to him and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't see any of my stuff posted anywhere at the meetings. And, you know, and it was interesting. And I just got busy in AA. I was getting service positions, getting involved, you know, being secretary of the meeting, chair of a meeting. We started this young people's bid committee, you know, bringing a big conference to the area. All, you know, we're just busy doing stuff. And, you know, one time I got a position as a hotel chair. And I had it for a month, and I didn't do anything. And I started to talk myself, you know, this is a really hard position, and I'm not the right person to do it. You know, there are much more qualified people. And I'm really glad I talked to my sponsor about this before I, you know, was going to give it up. You know, I said, I called him one day, and I said, hey, think about, you know, turning over my chair position for this hotel thing. And he said, no, you're not going to do that. You know, you're going to do what's asked of you. You know, you're going to do what you signed up for. You know, you're going to do what you said you're going to do. And so do it, you know. And he had me ask for help, you know, talk to people who previously done it to get how they did it, you know. And so I did that. And then I started calling these hotels, and I started talking to these salespeople and doing this stuff, you know. And then I had that position for many years after that, you know. And you know, it became something that I felt like I could do, you know. And I was gonna quit. See, I'm a quitter, you know. I you know, loved that man. He was also the type that would he was like an expert at the subtle arts a sponsorship, because sometimes you can go head on and it only causes repulsion. He would come in through the side door or the back door or maybe a trap door and have you be able to see things about yourself that you might not ever be able to see. And he had a really amazing skill like that. you know, one time we are hanging out with friends playing football, you know, it's fall. We go to one of the guy's house and eat all his parents' food, go to his basement. And a lot of us are sponsored by the same guy. And so somebody said, let's call our sponsor. And so Brian talked to Mike first and then Jack, and then it was my turn. And Mike asked me, how you doing, buddy? I said, you know, okay, you know, just kind of in my head, you know, all this kind of stuff. He's all, have I ever told you about the Fufu Bert? I said, no, Fufu Bert. Mm-hmm. He said, well, the Fufu Bert lives on the cliffs by the ocean, and they would build nests, and they would fly down to the water, catch fish, feed their young, you know, very happy birds. He said, one day, all the Fufu Birds got up out of the nest, flew into the air, and they started circling down to the water. And the circles got tighter and tighter until all of their heads flew up their asses. They fell to the water. They died. And now the Fufu Birds are extinct. I said, that's horrible. Like, you know, he said, you don't want to die like a Fufu Bird, do you? And I said, no, of course not. That's horrible. He said, well, go talk to Jack. He needs some help. You know, and I said, hey, Jack, I'm supposed to help you. You know, and Jack needed to go break up with his girlfriend and didn't have a car. So I was his driver. And anyway, so I did that. And a few days later, I ended up, I was coming home. I think at this point, I'm living with him in that same basement I did the fifth step in for a few years. And it hit me. He thinks I have my head up my ass. I'm not dumb, you know? And, so that's how he was. And I, you know, I really loved him. And, you know, after the fifth step, you know, I really, my life just kind of took off in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those feelings when I walked into a meeting went away. I wasn't so concerned about what people were looking at or didn't have to check my fly when I walked in, you know, I wasn't concerned where I was going to sit when I got to the coffee shop after the meeting. When I went to sleep at night, my head would hit the pillow and I would fall asleep for the first time ever, you know, so there was something working here. And I got really involved, really busy. A few years later, I'm going through a period, I'm going to wrap this up here. You know, of unemployment, 6 years sober, you know, just unemployed for a year. And it was both a low and a very free and happy spot. And I'm walking back from the gym and I'm walking because I don't have a car because I can't afford one. And, you know, I start thinking about my father. You know, when he was the age I was then, which was around 31, he had had a home, two cars, two kids, and he was doing very well in life. And as much as I hated him, he was a much better person at life than I ever was. You know, I'm living in a cricket infested basement, you know, barely making it. And it hit me that he did the very best he could, you know, and I started to feel very sick in my stomach and I started to see, and I did not. I was a shitty son. I was a crappy son. And thank God for credit cards. I ended up, you know, flying back home and doing a formal face-to-face amends with him. And I tell you what, you know, my parents, you know, up until that point, 6 years sober, they would call and I may or may not call them back. It might be weeks. They would have to be lucky enough to call when I'm in the house to talk to me, right? But I would not call them unless I needed something. And, but I tell you what, after that amends and what I've learned in AA, you know, we became friends and, we became current with each other. He knew what was going on in my life. I didn't hate him anymore. I saw him as he was. I saw myself as I was, you know, and, or as best I could at the time. And I tell you what, you know, through the years, you know, I told him, he was the first one I told that I was going to ask this girl to marry me. And my parents were the first people we told after we got married that she was pregnant with her first child. And when he died 5 months later, he knew everything that was going on in my life. He knew we were trying to buy a house, we're going to have a child, all this kind of stuff. And, when I went home to help my mom, for a couple of weeks, for the funeral and everything, cleaning out the pockets of his pants that he was wearing that day was my little AA chip that I'd send him every year, my 6-year chip. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous that we were reconnected. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous that the poison of hate got out of me. And we were able to be friends, and that was able to be mended before he passed. And I'm really, really grateful for that. And I'm really grateful for you asking me to come down here, Billy. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm Curtis, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Arno, so much for such a great talk. And man, it's amazing the people that God puts in our lives to get us here, help get us here. Also the Fufu Bird. I don't think I'll forget that one. Let's pass the seventh tradition basket. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While the basket's being passed, we have passed AA speaker CDs for a buck a piece on this table, AA literature, books and stuff at cost on the middle table, and free AA pamphlets on the back table. And Michael brought some snacks for anybody who wants them. Are there any AA related announcements? Nobody.